Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, Bill O'Reilly's going to join us for a long-form interview for the second half. Some of you love Bill O'Reilly. Some of you hate Bill O'Reilly. This is a very interesting Bill O'Reilly because we just talk American history and the Indian Wars, a big chunk of stuff that nobody knew about, including me going into it. So that's a lot. And then a little politics toward the end. I think you guys are going to learn a lot from this interview. First, I'll tell you about LifeLock. Certain behaviors, well, they make you more vulnerable. And identity theft can, you can have your identity stolen. Like if you use the same password for every account or you overshare personal information on social media. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Every day we put our information at risk on the internet. You can miss certain threats by just monitoring your credit alone. Good thing. There's LifeLock. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If they detect your information, they'll send you an alert, but you're going to be good because you're covered by LifeLock. Right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but you can find out if your information is on the dark web. Get your free dark web scan at LifeLock.com/scan. Pick the plan that's right for you and save up to 25% off your first year with promo code Adam. That's a free scan at LifeLock.com/scan and 25% off with promo code Adam.
The Adam Carolla Show presents Bill O'Reilly's Birthday Cocktail Party for September 10th. Let's see who's here. Golfing legend and a refreshing drink, Arnold Palmer. Toxic twin, Joe Perry. Colin Firth. Madonna's ex, Guy Ritchie. Ryan Felipe. American farmer and signer of the Declaration of Independence, Carter Braxton. John Lennon's first wife, Cynthia Lennon. From Three Dog Night, Danny Hutton. Let's say Feliz Navidad to Jose Feliciano. And German Shepherd, Rin Tin Tin. Happy belated birthday, Bill. Let's get back to the Adam Carolla Show.
Bill O'Reilly has joined us. The book, Killing Crazy Horse, The Merciless Indian Wars in America. It's available now on Amazon and has been part of a hugely successful killing series. Good to speak to you again, Bill.
Carolla, how you doing out there?
I'm doing well. I'm interested in this story, so let's talk about that. We can talk about politics. We can talk about life. We can talk about business. But let's start with the book. How do you pick your subjects for the Killing series?
Well, we started with Killing Lincoln, Killing Crazy Horse, the ninth Killing book, the most successful nonfiction book series of all time. I mean, that's just staggering for me to think about that. And all of the books that I have written, I wanted to know more about the subject. That's how I choose the topics. So in Killing Crazy Horse, I'm a former high school history teacher. And there's a huge gap in my knowledge of American history from 1813 to 1890, 77 years of Indian Wars. I knew nothing about it other than remembering John Wayne movies, Rin Tin Tin, who I share a birthday with, chasing some people around the prairie. I don't know anything. So my co-author, Martin Dugard, who lives in California, I said, look, let's find out what really happened. Make these people come alive. You know, real people, Cochise, Geronimo, Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, Tecumseh. Who are they? What do they do? And were the white people really that bad? Did we steal everything from them? So we found out, and we tell you the truth, and it's disturbing in many pages, but there's heroes and villains on both sides, and I think people, after reading this book, will be able to fend off the far-left propaganda machine that wants you to think America's evil. And you'll be armed with facts. You'll learn a tremendous amount, and it's fun to read the book.
Well, let's start with the most basic stuff. I'm the same way which is I know a lot about World War II, for instance, and World War I, and even Vietnam. I sort of know a lot about wars but and battles and stuff, but I really don't know anything about the American West and the Indians. And because I think these people became sort of cartoons to me when I was a kid. It was cowboys and Indians, and they were depicted always in an over-the-top, sort of farcical, cartoonish, good and bad sort of way. Like, there was a cartoon version that was the evil, bloodthirsty savage. And then there was also the over-the-top sort of Billy Jack, you know, proud Indian crying by the side of the road while the person was polluting the highway. And both of them were probably caricatures and almost cartoon versions of the American Indian. We had the worst depictions early, the bloodthirsty savages, and then later they became the most noble people in the world. But the truth, as usual, lies somewhere in between.
Look, in school, you cannot learn about the Native American wars because the public school system is frightened of the topic. The teachers and the principals are afraid they might be politically incorrect. They might say something wrong. They might use a wrong phrase. They might wear a Washington Redskins cap, and they'll be canceled. All right? So the solution to that problem is not teach anything about it. So you go from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War to Teddy Roosevelt. And then, well, what happened between the Revolutionary War and Teddy when millions of people move west to California? And here's something, Carolla. Here's something for you. You'll love this. So the Washington Redskins are gone because you don't want to talk about skin color. But the San Francisco 49ers, Carolla, they're okay. The 49ers. Well, who were they? They came in 1849 in Northern California, decimated the Native Americans who lived there, stole their land so they could pan for gold, discover gold. And San Francisco is glorifying the 49ers. I am outraged, Carolla. You have to cancel that name and change the name of the San Francisco football team to the San Francisco Pelosis. And of course, you're going to need a new logo, and that's got to be a hairdryer right on the side of the helmet.
So tell us about, let's just start sort of large to small. First, we are moving west. And when we move, when the many people in this country start migrating west, that's when we start really encountering these wars and these situations and these chiefs? Is that when it begins?
No, a little bit before then. We begin with 1813 in the Creek Nation in northern Florida. They're fed up. All right, you got white people coming down. They're killing a game. They're invading their homeland. And the Creeks say enough. And the leader of the Creeks, a guy named William Weatherford. Here's how fascinating this whole book is. William Weatherford was educated in Philadelphia. He's half white, half Creek. He decides to lead his nation. So what do? They massacre 300 people, mostly whites, but some slaves, in Fort Mims, South Alabama. Kill everybody. All right? In a grisly way. We put you right inside the fort in Killing Crazy Horse. Who are you going to call? Andrew Jackson. He's up in Tennessee, Nashville. Somebody just shot him. He's got a bullet he can't get out of him. He's got now two bullets in his body. And President Madison says, you got to get down there and put these Creeks in their place because they're slaughtering people. Jackson does. He goes down to Alabama, a big battle of Horseshoe Bend, defeats the Creeks. That's where it started. All right. Jackson becomes a pivotal figure because he becomes president. And he knows the Indians because he fought them hand to hand. Jackson was sympathetic. In fact, adopted an Indian baby whose parents were killed in the fighting and raised the child as his own with his wife. And then Jackson is responsible for migrating all these Indians from the East Coast west of the Mississippi, the Trail of Tears, in a not nice way.
Right.
Now you got a whole bunch of Indian tribes west of the Mississippi. Congress passes a law that says if you're a white man, you cannot live west of the Mississippi. Nobody knows that. But Congress passed that law. Okay. Of course, nobody obeyed the law because there's no law west of the Mississippi. Nobody's there.
Right.
So these millions of white people came from Europe. They can't read or write. They have no skills. They migrate west just to get a farm so they can raise their families, all right, in freedom. And they run up against the Native Americans who have been on this land for hundreds of years going, what the deuce are you doing? This is our land. And then the fighting begins. All right. So Washington says, uh-oh, we have to protect these settlers. Now, the key to all of this is the fake news industry, Corolla. There was fake news in the 19th century. Just as you said, very astutely, they didn't report why the Native Americans were angry or the abuse that they had suffered under Washington. They simply reported every massacre the Indians did. And they were savages and they were brutal and they didn't deserve to live. Well, that was how the whole view of the Native American tribes was formed on the East Coast, the people who could read. Mm-hmm. But the settlers, they didn't know what they were getting into. And so the wars began, 77 years continuously of war.
How much of the war, and it's maybe not an answer, a non-answerable question, but the settlers were white, they were European, they were uneducated. They had never probably seen Indians where they come from. Was there a racial component to this from the beginning, or was it just a dude who was there on land that I wanted, or was race injected into this at some point with the news stories on the East Coast?
It wasn't so much race. It was their godless heathens. And mm-hmm. when the pilgrims came over and settled in Massachusetts, the Indians saved their butts. The Indians of Massachusetts saved the pilgrims. They would all die. But the Indians were friendly there. And they traded and they taught the pilgrims how to grow stuff, how to survive the winters, all of that. In New York, when the Dutch sailed up the Hudson, all right, they ran into the Iroquois, not friendly. Mm-hmm. The Iroquois were very, very warlike tribe. So there were different tribes, and the difference was how they wanted to engage the white people. Some tribes wanted to kill them and torture them. Other tribes wanted to trade and be friends. What so it didn't have a racial component. It was more of, are you aggressive or are you willing to live side by side?
So would it be fair to say that tribes sort of had personalities like breeds of dogs? Like some dogs are very aggressive and can hurt you. Others are more docile, good with kids. You know what I mean? So there were some like Labrador tribes and there were some sort of pit bull tribes, or they just had different personalities, I'm guessing, that were infusing them over the years.
But here's the fascinating part about the Native American culture. The tribes were totally dependent on their leaders. And if the leader was a psychopath, then the tribe went that way. But if the leader was enlightened, like Chief Joseph in the Nez Perce up in the Pacific Northwest, then the tribes tended to be reasonable. So we teach you about Cochise, Geronimo, Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, Joseph, Tecumseh, all the big names that Americans know blank about. They don't know anything about these people. Now, some of them were very noble, all right? But some of them were brutal. And the most brutal tribe were the Comanches in Texas, northern Mexico, and Oklahoma. You did not want to be captured by the Comanches ever. They were not going to brook you. And they fought other Indian tribes. And that's what, and again, it wasn't as unified. They were all different. No cities, no citadels, no central government. So when the whites came in from Europe and from the East Coast, they were used to structure. Mm-hmm. They were used to a town, and then you had a sheriff, and you had a judge. Indians didn't have anything like that. They were nomadic, all right? So that there was this clash of culture. And it wasn't so much race, all right? It was like, you're totally different than we are. We want your land. And the Indians go, you're not getting it. And that's why the wars began.
Slightly kind of off the wall question, but at some point the Indians got hold of like Winchester rifles.
Right.
Where did they get those Winchester rifles?
Well, from their victories over the U.S. Army.
So they would then confiscate the rifles.
Yeah. Cochise was never defeated. Never. In Arizona. They could not beat him. Crazy Horse, never defeated until after the Little Bighorn, Custer's last stand. These were brilliant tacticians. And that's another thing that Americans don't know. These are really sophisticated makers of war. And they would attack envoys. They would attack forts. They would attack when the railroad got up. And that was really the beginning of the end of the Native American culture. Once the railroad went from St. Louis to San Francisco, they could get U.S. troops there fast with mm-hmm. cannons and guns. Mm-hmm. But the Indians initially were able to raid, and Mexico was a big part of this. The Indians raided the Mexican, and Mexican army is petrified of the Indian nation, and steal all their stuff, guns, horses, ammo, women, alcohol, you name it. And that's where they became armed.
What kind of things would the Apaches do to you if they took you prisoner?
It wasn't so much the Apaches. It was the Comanches.
Oh, Comanches. Excuse me.
Right. The Apaches were brutal if cornered. Mm-hmm. But the Apaches were more basically, leave us alone.
Yes.
Comanches were very aggressive. Very aggressive. So the Comanche, there's a Comanche moon, and it's coming up in October for all you people in California, if you can see it through the wildfires. Big harvest moon, and they call it the Comanche moon because the moon is so bright that everybody in the area of Texas, northern Mexico, Oklahoma knew the Comanches would raid at night because they could see mm-hmm. the horses. They could see where they were going. They called it the Comanche moon. If they got you, it was mostly torture by fire. And, you know, we have to lay it out in Killing Crazy Horse. We have to tell you what they did, and it's really amazingly brutal. In fact, so bad that the U.S. Army taught their soldiers, if you run out of ammo, you leave one bullet in the chamber. And you know what that was for, Corolla?
It was for putting the gun in your mouth.
That's right. So every soldier, and most of the soldiers who went west were immigrants, all right, who signed up in the army. Every soldier knew you don't get captured. You have to kill yourself.
Was it when they would torture you, it obviously wasn't to get information out of you. It wasn't really to benefit. It was to send a message, I suppose. I mean, was there any method behind the madness?
No, it was fun, sport, and the Indian women did the torturing.
Oh, really?
Torture was beneath the men. They'd turn it over to women, and the women would torture, and there was no reason to do it. They didn't send any message. The message was sent when they burned down the farms, and, right. you know, that was it, and they killed the soldiers. But this was just for fun.
And the women would be the ones who would carry it out.
Yeah, it's kind of like what it is now symbolically, but it was physically back. No. This is a jest.
Yes.
This is a joke for the Corolla viewers.
So it is funny. I don't think I've ever seen that depicted in a movie. Going along with all the things we get wrong over the years. So we have the settlers. They're heading west. They're running into the Indians. The Indians, they vary from tribe to tribe, but what is their general view of life? Do they have a religion? Is their religion more sort of nature, spirit based? Are they schooling? I know they're nomadic, but what would be a sort of a general term you could say, like, here's how these people lived?
Basically a nature based faith. That there was a great spirit who created all of the things that the Native Americans needed to survive. They were very respectful of animals and the environment. If they killed a buffalo, they used every part of the buffalo, some for food, some for the tents, the buffalo horns. Every part of the animal was used, no abuse. They were appalled by the white man just gunning animals down, shooting them out of trains. And that was a big, big bone of contention between the Indians and the whites. They were not people who prayed. They did have a shaman, which was attached to the various tribes, who would, you know, do the basic, okay, the higher power wants us to kill everybody in Fort Kearney, so here we go. But their lifestyle, most of the Native American tribes, and there were exceptions. I can go to Mesa Verde in Colorado and see. There were exceptions of tribes that did stay in one place and they farmed a little bit. But most of them would go south when it was cold, north when it was hot, follow the big buffalo herds where they went. And they were used to fending for themselves. They didn't rely on anything other than the tribe in which they were living. And it was a very fascinating, fascinating culture. But they did war among themselves. There was a lot of that. It wasn't just the white man they were after.
How large were some of these tribes in terms of numbers?
Well, Crazy Horse had 5,000 warriors.
Wow.
When Custer showed up with about 800 men. Now, Custer was so arrogant, you know, he had the suede jacket, the red cravat, the flowing blonde hair, the little hat on in a jaunty manner. He said, you know, 800 crack U.S. troops can take a couple of thousand warriors. He didn't know there were 5,000. There weren't any drones then to give him intel.
Right.
And Custer, you know, was very confident that he was going to go in and kick their butt. But anyway, there weren't, because of the food aspect, the tribes were kept in a manageable way. And you could be a part of the Sioux tribe. There were a lot of different Sioux. There were the Ogala, that was Crazy Horse, but there were a lot of them. But they didn't all band together because it'd be too hard to feed everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of scattered around. But for Crazy Horse, he managed to unite a lot of tribes to go get Custer. And that's led to his demise.
What was their language? Did they have a common language?
No. They all spoke different languages. In fact, the southern Indians, Apaches, Comanches, people down there, they spoke a lot of Spanish because they had to interact with the Mexican government and trade and all that. And some of them learned English, you know, the smarter of them. But the Indian dialects vary from area to area, and that was another reason they didn't unify. So they had their own language, they had their own culture, they had their own point of view, and they wanted to stay fairly compact. So there was no big push. Tecumseh tried it. He tried to unite all of the Indian tribes to, you know, fend off this migration that was coming over the Allegheny Mountains. And, you know, William Henry Harrison defeated Tecumseh and killed him, and that was the end of him.
How much innovation or technology, for lack of a better term, was involved with them in terms of water, storing food, you know, shelter and things of that nature? Like, was there innovation with some of the tribes?
Well, there was, and very interestingly, they used plants and they use everything, you know, for various ailments. But life expectancy for Native Americans in the 19th century was, you know, 50, 48. Some of the tribal elders, you know, reached 70, 75, particularly when they assimilated with whites. But here's a fascinating part of killing Crazy Horse Corolla. And you'll find this interesting, I believe. Martin Dugard is my co-author and researcher. We didn't take what happened from the white point of view. In the Custer case, we couldn't because there were no white people surviving that battle. We took most of our information from the oral history that was passed down from the tribes from generation to generation. And then as the 19th century progressed, some of the tribe members learned how to write English and wrote it down.
Mm-hmm.
the Battle of the Little Bighorn, we tell exclusively from the Native American point of view. Again, because there was no white point of view. They're all dead. All right. And it's fascinating because the oral history is very, very precise. Mm-hmm. And they get down to, you know, this is what Crazy Horse did, what Sitting Bull did. This is what the Braves did. And fascinating. I'll give you one nugget. Custer, with Custer and Crazy Horse, it was personal. It was macho, mano a mano. Okay. He was the only body on the battlefield that wasn't mutilated.
Custer.
Right. Because Crazy Horse told his warriors, kill him, but don't touch him after that. Because the Indians had all the superstition. If you cut off this or cut off that, you can't go to the heaven or whatever.
Happy Custer hunting ground, I think they call it.
Whatever it may be. Yeah. I would never use that phrase.
It's been in songs I heard from the 50s.
Yes, I know.
So
that's how sophisticated it was.
So were all 800 of Custer's men killed and or mutilated?
No, because Custer divided his force into three.
Mm-hmm.
Big mistake. Mm-hmm. Custer led one, Reno led another, Benteen led another. When Custer got into trouble, Custer went into the Sioux village, rode in on horseback with his guys. Then they said, uh-oh, we got 300, they got 5,000, we better get the deuce out of here, which they tried to do. But Crazy Horse anticipated that and had surrounded them, and they couldn't escape. Benteen and Reno, all right, both colonels, knew what was happening and were too frightened, and so were all their guys, to go to Custer's relief, to reinforce him. And Reno and Benteen both got tried by the U.S. government for cowardice. But they wouldn't go in because they knew what the outcome was going to be.
Right, so they surrounded Custer's 275 men or so, and they just slaughtered them that way.
Yeah, it took about 45 minutes. Custer's brother, his brother-in-law, his cousin, two newspaper reporters. I was hoping they were going to be from the New York Times, but they weren't, from a Dakota newspaper. That was another jest. Sure. And everybody dead. In about 45 minutes.
How many Indians were killed in that? Do you know?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
Because the oral history of the battle did not compute that. All right? So all the Indian casualties were removed from the battlefield. The Indians left all the whites there. All right? So they could count how many were dead. If you go to South Montana now, the Custer battlefield is there with markers on where everybody died. It's a U.S. National Park. So, but the Indians took their dead and wounded, and there was no oral history of numbers.
Were most of the American soldiers back then Europeans or
yes.
Like young immigrants?
Absolutely.
I guess sort of in a way, a lot of military are in our modern day time are Hispanics and blacks and, you know, folks, some new to this country, but some it's usually a sort of lower middle class. You're going to take this job because you don't have an uncle that has a successful business. You can't go work with him. You have to join the military.
Right.
Essentially. Right. Same held back then.
Yeah, because the Civil War was a turning point. During the Civil War, all of the U.S. government troops were pulled back to fight the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. So the Indians ran wild out west. So if you were unlucky enough to be in Tucson, Arizona, you were protected by the U.S. Army fort nearby, but all of a sudden, they were gone. Mm-hmm. They got called back to fight the Confederates. And the Indians said, hey, this is good. We'll just go on and kill everybody, which they did. All right. So, but after the Civil War, a lot of the Union troops stayed in the Army. And they were hardened veterans. But many of them were from Ireland, Germany, those two countries in particular, would come to the U.S., didn't have an economic basis, no education. And the Army paid them. And they became professional soldiers. And then after the Civil War, they were moved out west and they said, look, we got to provide a measure of protection for the people out there. And so here come the blue coats. And then, as I said, the railroad made that much easier to do. You didn't have to ride out there. You could go on a railroad and get out there much faster with heavy artillery, cannon and guns and all of that. And that was the end of the Indians, the railroad.
Interesting. Was the primary weapon for the Indian before they got the Remingtons, sort of from the white man, essentially, was it arrow? Was it a battle axe or tomahawk? I mean, were they as skilled at shooting the arrows on horseback? Was it accurate? Was it an effective method for killing people?
The primary weapon for many, not all, but many Native American tribes was the lance.
Oh, the lance.
Like, right. Like medieval Europe.
Right.
Because with the big lance, and they had the tip, the steel tip, all right, or it was stone or whatever, they could do unbelievable things with it. They could throw it like a javelin. They could stab the earth if they were hunting. Mm-hmm. They could get a rabbit or whatever they were after. Boom. And the lance, they could, when they fought other Indians without firearms, it was who's stronger on the horse, right?
Right.
Boom. Now, for other long range battles, it was the bow and arrow, mainly with fire.
Mm.
So when they were sieging the forts, they would go boom, throw the flaming arrow because all the forts were wood.
Right.
And boom, they'd all go up. And then close in off the horse, it was a tomahawk and the knife. And all the Indian victims were scalped. That was the mark of a brave warrior. How many scalps did you get?
Mm-hmm.
It was a tomahawk and the knife hand to hand.
I guess they had the ability to shape metal, or was everything sharpened stone?
As the culture progressed, the weapons got more sophisticated. So they didn't have, you know, like forging and iron and anything like that. But they could steal. And whatever the white man had, the Indians had. So, for example, you have train tracks, right?
Right.
So the tribes would just pull the train tracks up. And they would use the steel of the train tracks to put on the edge of the lance.
Right.
Or the arrow. In the beginning, it was stone. And then it got more sophisticated. The Indians were foragers. That's what they did. They went out and they would take anything that you had. So, say they attack a house. Well, all the pots and pans in the house going to the Indian village for a variety of reasons. They were unbelievably creative in how they used everything, the Native Americans.
God, it's really interesting to hear these people sort of become people and not cartoon characters, as you
I wrote the book.
Yeah.
That's why I wrote it. Because Americans don't know anything about it.
No.
And that's a pretty big gap in knowledge. I am so tired, Carl, and I know you are too. I am so tired of far-left people saying that we're an evil country. We got to blow everything up. No more statues. Our history is terrible. White supremacists. And it's so much more complicated than that in almost every regard. My job with these 9 killing books is to tell you the truth about what happened. Then you can make an educated opinion of your country.
Well, I agree. And, you know, the way I always sort of look at it is, being evil or being racist or wanting to randomly hurt people is sort of a luxury meets a waste of time. You know what I mean? When you're poor and you're hungry and you're desperate and you're nomadic, or you're trying to get from the eastern part of the country to the western part of the country, being racist or just being evil is kind of a waste of time. You know, your priorities are to get fed and to get shelter and to get whatever. And you can hurt people along the way who don't look like you, but that doesn't mean you're racist. You know, it's a luxury.
There was a religious fervor that made people, white people, cruel, that because they're not Christians and they're, you know, savages and not atheists, but they have no traditional religion, that we can do what we want with them. There was that. All right. But you're absolutely right. If you were just forging ahead, trying to survive out there, the Indian could be your best friend. I mean, Daniel Boone knew that. Davy Crockett knew that. Both of those guys are in Killing Crazy Horse. They knew. I mean, look, if you can make friends with some Native Americans, they can help you a lot, as the pilgrims learned firsthand. But then you had this religious aspect to it that, you know, was not a good thing.
Well, I want to talk about Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett and turn them into human beings instead of cartoon characters as well. Of course, we all grew up with Davy Crockett, and I think Fess Parker may have played Daniel
Fess
Boone.
Parker. Absolutely.
It's a deep dive, and they made some Disney movies and TV shows. But again, everything was a sort of Hollywood sort of caricature.
Do you remember
cartoon.
The song, Corolla?
Davy Crockett.
Davy Crockett.
King of the Wild Frontier.
Yeah.
We should do
that
a Christmas.
Fess Parker.
We should do a Christmas album together. All right, let me hit
Chipmunks.
Let me hit True Nijin, and we'll break, and we'll talk about those two characters, because once again, I only know what the Walt Disney Corporation taught me about those two. First, I'll tell you about True Nijin. I've been taking True Nijin. It's a daily supplement for about 6 months now. I feel great. As a matter of fact, I took it this morning with some other supplements, and then I thought, wait a minute, did I take my True Nijin pill? So I just took another one just to play it safe. NAD is a vital cellular resource that supports daily function, eating, sleeping, and breathing as well. As we get older, NAD levels may decline by as much as 50% due to stressors like aging, alcohol, lack of exercise, sun exposure, and more. When NAD levels get low, the cells have a harder time producing energy they need to perform at their best. So there's only one NAD supplement I trust. It's True Nijin. They've done 11 clinical studies, Nobel Prize winning scientists, and global research and regulatory acceptance as well. So make age just a number. Visit True Nijin, TRUNIAGEN.com. Use the code Adam at checkout and save $20 on any 3 month supply. All right, quick break. We come right back with Bill O'Reilly. We get into Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and those guys right after this.
Just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from HBS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
You heard Dick. It's time for another ballsy month of Adam's Monthly Nut. This month includes two Vinnie Tortorich approved and invented ultra fat instant energy packs so you don't reach for that donut. Four shot glass ice molds so you can keep your whiskey cold and straight down the hatch. A bottle of Chateau Spill to remove wine stains or blood from the fine silk you're donning. Of course, a bottle of your choice. And the coup de grace, a digital download of the very first basic cable commentary, Roadhouse. This $60 value can be yours for only $25 at CorollaDrinks.com.
Bill O'Reilly is with us. Killing Crazy Horse is the name of the book. It is available on Amazon as we speak. I find this subject fascinating. I'm also happy to report that Bill is not just a spokesmodel, that he actually knows these subjects, because I literally was just all over the road quizzing him about all these things that I vaguely know, and he has a very astute answer for all of them. So thanks for not just being the name on the book, but actually being intimately familiar with the subject matter. We were talking about Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone. Talk about those two characters.
So I have in my possession, in my history collection, the deed when Daniel Boone sold his Kentucky home and acreage because he was fed up with too many people coming into the bluegrass state and wanted to move to Missouri, where nobody was. So Daniel was this feisty guy, had been on the periphery of helping the new United States government move into Kentucky, had fought the British during the War of 1812, was a scout. That's right. But he didn't like folks. Daniel didn't like people. He's like, I like you, Corolla. He had a little hat, but it was a coonskin hat. And he kind of was a scout, all right? But he had money because he rented his services out to business people who wanted to explore the Midwest. So he moves to Missouri, doesn't work out for him there, and he comes back. Not a real consequential guy in U.S. history other than the name and the legend. Davy Crockett's different. I have a letter from Davy Crockett. He was a congressman from Tennessee, only served one term because he couldn't stand Washington and sit in the office. Davy was an outdoors guy, a raucous guy, Indian fighter from the jump. Good shot, didn't really like conventionality, got married, abandoned his wife and kids, kind of floated all over the place. Did work for Andrew Jackson for a little while, but he found his way out to Texas because Davy was restless. He's a restless guy. He wanted action. He said, let me go out to Texas and see what's going on out there. Unfortunately, Davy wound up in the Alamo, and that was the end of Davy. Okay, but he was much more of a presence in history. I mean, he was an explorer. He was an Indian fighter. Then he fought the Mexican army at the Alamo. And, you know, a very flamboyant guy that left a much bigger trail, pardon the pun, than Daniel Boone.
I believe, and I'm going to ask my producer, Chris, you can look it up. Didn't Zucker or Abrams of airplane fame and Naked Gun and all that, wasn't one of them a big Daniel Boone memorabilia collector? I don't know, Bill, if you know that story, but the Zucker Abrams guys who obviously have done all those Naked Gun and airplane movies and Police Squad and sort of beyond all those comedies. I think it's Zucker Abrams. One of them has a large collection of Daniel Boone.
It's Davy Crockett.
Oh, Davy
huge
Crockett.
Davy Crockett fan.
Damn it. A huge Davy Crockett
very
fan.
Very valuable. There's not a lot of Davy Crockett stuff around. I have a letter written by then Congressman Crockett with a lot of misspellings, Corolla. I got to tell you, a lot of misspellings in the letter.
Well, you know, frontier cursive. We'll give them a break. Right. They didn't have spell check on their quills.
So, that's for sure.
So I can't even get spell check on Twitter. I'm screwed. So were these guys... What would they have been? Would they have been your rowdy friends from high school that drank a little too much? Would they have been, you know, sort of the quiet guy who kept to himself, who didn't want neighbors? Like, I'm trying to sort of think of who these guys would be today.
You know, I don't know if they could survive because both Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett were people who didn't like civilization very much. They didn't want to settle down. They didn't want to conform. They didn't want to have a job or be a farmer. They wanted adventure. Mm-hmm. So maybe they'd be in the CIA or one of those things. But they were explorers, and they just wanted to get out there and see what was over the next mountain. That's who they were. They weren't gunfighters. They weren't looking. They weren't aggressively violent. They just wanted action. And Boone, it worked out okay for him, but Crockett was killed. I mean, he was 34 when he died.
At the Alamo.
Right.
And how did they befriend the Indians? How did they have these sort of relationships where they could travel through their territories?
Well, Boone was such a skilled woodsman that the Indians in Kentucky and Ohio respected him. because he was like the first guy out there. And he was this eccentric guy who lived like the Indians, lived in the same kind of a, you know, we hunt, we cook, we eat, we go to sleep, we get up, we hunt, you know, do it again. Yeah, they built a cabin, but the Indians and Daniel Boone had a lot in common. Crockett was more of a guy who was very charismatic. They loved him. He was a macho man, Andrew Jackson's friend, good shot, good with a knife. You know, he was kind of the guy that walks in the bar and everybody wants to buy him a drink.
Right.
That was Davey. Boone was much more solitary.
You know, it worries me, and I'm sure it worries you too as well, this sort of version of history that we're trying to teach all the kids these days, which I feel like is sort of poisoning them in the modern time through sort of taking these people and turning them into very negative cartoon characters. And there's so much to glean from the history, good and bad. Do you worry about what is being taught and how it's being taught in the school 16-19 project and things of that nature, sort of Black Lives Matter manifesto and that sort of stuff?
Well, I do worry about it because parents are becoming increasingly derelict in their responsibility to make sure their children know about their country. So history, you know, they can't teach about Native Americans, Corley. You can't do that. And they don't, because you make one false statement or you wear a Washington Redskins cap, like I said, and you're canceled. So every history teacher knows, oh, no, we're not going to get into this Native American stuff. We're going to go right from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War to Teddy Roosevelt. And no in between, because I might say something wrong. And then a little Zeke is going to go home and Heather and go, oh, they said this about the Native American. And then all of a sudden the teacher's up against on charges in front of the school board. You're a racist. You're that. So it's not taught. And therefore, we get an army of younger Americans who know absolutely nothing about their country. You remember a segment I did on The Factor called Waters World, mm-hmm. where I sent Jesse Waters out to ask people even the basics. And nobody knew anything.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where we are in this country.
It was like a historical jaywalking Leno.
And Leno stole it from me, just to be clear. We did it way back. And people would say, oh, no, you just took the dumb people. No, we did it random time. We didn't edit. This is who we talked to. This is what they said. We didn't select the dumb people. All right. And when you have a population that doesn't know anything, then they'll swallow propaganda on both sides, on both the left and the right. And that's my mission in these killing books. You read Killing Lincoln, Killing England, Killing Crazy Horse, you'll know how your country was formed. You read those through book, you'll know.
By the way, the broadcast show, No Spin News, weeknights, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific, on the First TV New Media Network. Yeah, so let's talk about that and Fox and such. I don't have a everything happens for a reason. I'm not that guy. I do believe that change is always good, even when it doesn't initially feel good. I lost a broadcast syndicated radio show job when I replaced Howard Stern, and CBS Radio cut me, 12 years ago. And I was disappointed and unhappy that I'd lost my job. Now, as I look back on it, probably the best thing that ever happened to me. How do you feel looking back on your relationship with Fox? And was it a blessing in disguise?
Well, I don't know about that, but I had been in corporate media for 42 years. I had been at Fox News Channel for more than 20. Very successful in all my venues. I work hard. I think I bring a unique view of life to whatever I do. But I had pretty much enough. And there was a big change in management in Fox. Roger Ailes left the company. And he was the originator of the concept. And I was left there by saying, all right, I mean, you know, we're doing real well. We're the number one rated cable news show. But I had to answer to a corporation. And then when the corporation didn't back me, I said, all right, well, I'll go do something else. And by that time, I was iconic. People knew who I was. I had tons of money in the bank, thank God, because money gives you options. And then I decided to form my own news agency, BillO'Reilly.com. Now, that has gone just this year alone from a $5 million company to a $25 million company in 9 months.
Wow.
Because of the pandemic and the racial stuff. Because people know I'll tell them the truth. You may not agree with me, but I'll back up what I say. And that's why the books. Do you know that Killing Crazy Horse in the first 2 weeks has sold more than 200,000 copies, Carolla?
That's a lot.
And Trump's not even in the book. I tried to get him in, but it's 150 years too early.
That's a lot of units.
Every book is, I love Trump, I hate Trump. This book is just a history book, 200,000 copies. So I wouldn't say it was a blessing, because you always want to go out on your own terms. And but it took me 48 hours to say, I'm going to start my own news agency. And
yeah.
Again, thank God. I believe in God. You don't. But who's more handsome, Carolla? That's what you have to say.
I don't say a blessing. I say in life, when there's a change, sometimes it's a relationship. Sometimes it's a boss. Sometimes it's a company you work for. I said, usually when you get a year away from that time of divorce or that time of being fired or that time of going separate ways or having to move or whatever that change is, usually when you look back on it, you're sort of happy that it turned out that way, because you would have never met this person or you never would have started this company. And that's the way I sort of look at it. Not that you're happy about it, just that it turned out to be a positive thing, because now you're doing something that you wouldn't have been doing.
That is a very wise assessment that you just put forth to your viewers. But there's one other factor involved. Because I got out of the corporate world, I could spend more time with my kids. I'm coming to you from my studio. It's in my house.
Right.
All right. Just like you. So I spent a lot of time in the teen years with the urchins. And that was an enormous plus. So I always spent time with them. But now I could be a presence that had an impact. And I don't talk about that kind of stuff very much. But that was an unintended consequence of this whole thing. That is the biggest positive of all.
Do you have a relationship with Tucker Carlson? Do you watch the show? Do you have any interest in the past and or Tucker?
Once in a while, I'll tune in to watch, to see what everybody's doing. I don't know Tucker very well. I know him a little bit, but he was in Washington. I was in New York. In the first couple of years after he took over for me, you know, he was doing all right, but then that show went into different areas where, like him or not, the guy is saying stuff that nobody else says. Mm-hmm. When you do that, it's like Stern. You mentioned Howard Stern. When you do that, there'll be an audience that comes to hear it. So he's not predictable. He says things that no one else will say on television. So I think he's doing fine.
Do you, on a personal note, because I suffer a little from this, you know, sometimes I'll meet people, I'll talk to them a little bit, I'll spend some time with them, and they'll go, I thought you were this kind of guy, but it turns out you're a nice guy, or you're not anything like I sort of thought you were, or you're sort of portrayed to be. And I suspect you suffer from that as well. It's kind of a two-way street, and it can go back and forth, like we've learned from Ellen recently, that she was being portrayed as this and now she's being portrayed as that. Do you feel like there's a caricature of you that's out there that most of America knows, but they don't, if they really knew more about you or more your interests, or would be surprised to find out X, Y, and Z, that you're, you know, very dedicated family man or a historian or former history teacher. Like, do you feel that you suffer from that?
Well, I don't even think about it. God's honest truth. I mean, I've known you, what, 20 years, Corolla?
Yes.
Okay, you know who I am.
Yes.
I mean, you know who I am, right? But people form impressions. I don't even think about them. I wrote a book called A Bold, Fresh Piece of Humanity, which is kind of a bio, a funny bio. My picture on the cover as an altar boy with my hands like this. People want to know about me. They can find out. But what I do is I kind of blithely go along. I put forth my opinion and I write my books. If you like them and me, I'm thrilled. If you don't, I don't care. I'm not in the persuasion business. All right. And I have to say, everybody in the world knows me, Corolla, which is a bad thing. But wherever I go, everybody knows me because 20 plus years in prime time on television will get you that.
Well, and being, I don't know, 6'4 or something like that. I mean, just.
Yeah, I'm 6'4 and, you know, but I'm not flamboyant in person. I don't try to draw attention to myself when I'm out in public. But the point I want to make was very few people are nasty to me or come on inappropriate. I wouldn't brook that. And you're right, I'm a big guy and maybe they don't want to mess with the Irish guy at this point. But I have to say 90% of my interactions with the public are positive and they know what I do. They know who I am. I don't do the personal stuff. I don't do the People magazine. I don't do any of that. All right. Because I know I'm never going to get a fair shake from it. Ever in a million years. It's not, the press isn't like it was 25 years ago. Now it's harpoon, harpoon, harpoon. That's what they love.
Well,
I'm not going to play the game.
I want to kind of circle back to something. I think you said you're not in the impression business, like
persuasion business.
Yes. Apache Comanche. Damn it. All right. So the persuasion business. So here's, I'm interested in this sort of psychological dynamic of things. So Hollywood is in the persuasion business. Everyone in Hollywood, that's kind of their business, the persuasion business. You're not in the persuasion business. And I don't know, neither is Ben Shapiro. They seem to have a certain ire, the Hollywood community, for the folks that aren't into the persuasion / popularity business, because that is their business. They don't say it out loud. I'm just wondering if there's a dynamic here somewhere, which is if they understand they're in the persuasion business mixed with the pop running for homecoming king and you're not, is that a dynamic that gets their ire up?
I am not a person who will pander, and you know that better than anybody. So if I see some guy named Monty and he runs CAA, I'm not going over and go, oh, I love what you do. That's never going to happen. All right. So let me give you a good example of your question, and this will answer your question. I did the David Letterman show about 14 times. Okay. And Letterman in the beginning despised me. And what he wanted to do, because I never cozied up to Letterman, I didn't say, hey, Dave, I like that tie or that monologue, the top 10 was the greatest ever. Never would I do that. I'm respectful and polite, but never do that. So he wanted to score points with his liberal crew, because Dave's an avowed liberal. And I was all right with me. I don't mind. So I'm on his show one time. I guess it was maybe the fourth time I was on there and promoting a book. And he says, you know, O'Reilly, 80% of what you say is crap. He said that to me, right?
Right.
On the air.
Right.
And there was a hush in the audience. Because, you know, he was sardonic, but that's pretty in your face, right?
Right. For a guest.
So I looked at him. I said, Dave, can you give me one example of that? Silence. He couldn't. And I said, if you can't give me one example, then how can you calibrate that 80% of what I'm saying is garbage? when you can't provide one thing to back that up? Isn't that a little disrespectful to your audience here? That was it. Okay? From that moment on, Letterman liked me. And in an interview, he said I was one of the best guests he's ever had on his program. And I could see it in his eyes. I bested him. All right? I never pandered to him. But I replied in an honest way. And no one in Hollywood would have done that.
Right.
They would have even either fallen apart and, you know, called for their press agent to tell them what to say, or they would have said, oh, Dave, you know, that's right. 80% of what I say is garbage. And I'll be better. I'll be better, Dave. But me, I'm saying, I don't care if David Letterman thinks that 80% of what I say is garbage. I couldn't care less. I just was curious to know how he arrived at that number.
Well,
and then when I was over, I got a standing O from his audience.
Wow.
That night.
True story. I got to hit a piece of business. I'll tease. We should talk a little modern day politics. I know you know Trump well. I'd like to hear your thoughts on chances for second term and what he needs to do and maybe what he doesn't need to do and Biden and so forth. We'll do that in 1 second. Let me hit ZipRecruiter. As an employer, you've got a lot on your plate nowadays, running your business, regulations, ensuring workplace safety, making hiring easy. That's ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter.com/Adams, where you go. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. Plus, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. Features like screening questions to filter candidates and an all-in-one dashboard to review and rate candidates as well. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. So if you need somebody or you want to put your resume out there, you go with ZipRecruiter, right, Dawson?
Right now, to try ZipRecruiter for free, our listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/Adam. That's ZipRecruiter.com/ADAM. ZipRecruiter.com/Adam. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
So, Bill, with our remaining few minutes, if you could, I've heard you speak pretty eloquently about Trump. I believe I heard you on my friend Dennis Prager's radio program a couple of weeks ago. Very insightful stuff from a person who knows Trump pretty well. What are your impressions? What are your thoughts? I don't know, 40 days out or so.
Well, I can't make any predictions now. I think next Tuesday in the debate, after that, we'll have some clarity. I wrote a book called The United States of Trump. It's a history book on the president. If you really want to understand him, and most people don't, and I understand, but if you really want to know about him and why he does what he does, you read The United States of Trump and you'll know. So at this point, it's a referendum on Donald Trump, the election on November 30. It's, do we want this guy for 4 more years or do we want him off the stage forever? And the nation is pretty much divided in half on it. All right. So then you have the Biden factor. If there was a charismatic, if Barack Obama had emerged this year, mm-hmm, rather than in 2008, Obama would have just won against Trump in a landslide.
Right.
If there were some alternative to the chaos that President Trump brings, because he does, mm-hmm, he brings chaos. That's not to say he hasn't been successful in his presidency, because he has been. If you just step back, take the emotion out of it, what he did with the economy was very, very impressive. He destroyed ISIS. He's got all of our enemies afraid of him. Now, Putin may be an exception to that, all right? But he did some good things. But if you read the LA Times and New York Times, Washington Post, he didn't do anything good ever,
right,
in his whole life.
Yeah, I mean, the moving of the embassy, the Middle East, I mean, that's pretty historic
Nobel
stuff.
Nobel Peace Prize nomination, sure. But he's done some things that have not been constructive for the country, basically because his personality is, I'm not going to take any crap.
Right.
All right. I'm going to tell David Letterman. See, he wouldn't have asked Letterman what I asked. Give me one example. He would have called Dave a name and then made fun of his hair.
Right.
That's what Trump would have done. Right. All right. So he creates this tension.
Right.
Now, Biden is going to come across next Tuesday night as the pacifier.
Right.
That I'm the experienced hand. I'm going to bring everybody together. And I, Joe Biden, I look at this barbarian. Let's get the Huns out of Washington and bring in the civilized people led by me. That's what he's trying to sell.
Right.
Trump, on the other hand, is not going to change, not going to pander. He's going to say, you're much better off under me, particularly if you're black or Hispanic, because I've got a rip-roaring economy. And once the COVID thing subsides, it's coming back strong. But if you elect those people, we're going to go into a recession. That's your choice. All right. Right. But there is one more factor involved for next Tuesday night when you watch the debate, which will be the most well-watched debate in the history of debates. Can Biden get his ideas across in a manner that makes you think the man is operating at 100%? Because I don't think he's operating at 100%. All right. I think he's down there in a 60 somewhere.
60 percentile. In terms of operation. Yes. Obviously, there's something going on beyond just being older than he was. When you see footage of him from 2015, he seems spry, you know, and clear. And obviously there's something neurological going on. The question is how much and how fast?
You know, I wrote a book called Killing Reagan. After Reagan was shot, a few months after he was inaugurated and almost died, his mental acuity collapsed. Public didn't know.
Right.
And this is the fascinating part about the book, Killing Reagan. They kept it from the American people. But some days, Reagan could not do his job. Couldn't do it. All right. But other days, he was clear. And he made a miraculous comeback from that awful situation. Biden could make the comeback. He could. I'm not a doctor. I don't know. But I follow this, as you know, as closely as any human being in the world follows it. And I don't think at times Joe Biden knows what he's saying. He's disconnected.
No,
to the words coming out of his mouth.
And
that's frightening. That is frightening.
I've spoken to Dr. Drew about this on more than one occasion. When you say over 200 million Americans have died of COVID-19, anyone can botch a number, anyone can misspeak, but to power on and not catch yourself, to not have,
right.
We all speak for a living. We all know we've mispronounced a person's name or a city or a number. And then you immediately stop and go back and fix it because there's a part of your brain that says, oops, you just said 200 million when you meant 200,000. Right. When you start getting into a neurological part of this, a little dementia or a little something going on, you'll push past that thing you said. It's not really misspeaking. It's not catching it. Your brain will catch it. We do it all the time. The good ones like Bill O'Reilly do it very rarely. But him powering forward with miscues is an interesting part, that it's not the miscue. It's the pushing past it, not stopping and correcting.
He doesn't hear it.
Right.
He doesn't hear it. Okay. Now, advance the story, which is what I always do. The problem with casting a vote for Joe Biden is that you're going to get somebody running the country, the most powerful man in the world, who at times can't process information. And because of that, is very afraid. Don't you think that Joe Biden isn't afraid? He is. All right. That's why he doesn't do press. That's why he doesn't do rallies. He's afraid. He knows that he's diminished. When you're afraid in a job like the president of the United States, you are susceptible to other people telling you what to do. And I believe that the Biden campaign is being run by Obama acolytes, all right, people like David Axelrod, and that the far left can't wait to get Joe in the office because everything they want, he may not support it, but he's not going to stand up against it because he's confused and frightened. If you see a confused and frightened man on the stage next Tuesday night, you have to vote for Donald Trump as much as you may loathe him. And that is what is going to happen. We'll either see a confused and frightened man, Joe Biden, or a person in command. And we don't know who's going to show up.
Well, my last comment slash question is I agree with what you're saying, but if this, in fact, is a referendum on Trump, then by nature, it doesn't much matter who the other person is. I agree, confused and weak and indecisive and all that kind of stuff is not going to be a good look. But if, in fact, it is really a referendum on Trump, then it's just a referendum on Trump. We'll take a coat rack over Trump.
There is 5 to 8% of Americans at this point are persuadable.
Right.
That will tell the tale.
That's the group.
And you know, with the internet, even if you don't watch the stupid debate, with this, everybody's going to see every mistake. The 5 to 8.
Hold on. A lot of people are listening and not watching. Bill just pointed at his groin. Sorry. Go ahead, Bill.
No, I pointed at the stupid machine.
Oh, the phone.
Which is
the phone.
Dominating our culture in every simple way. But look, summing up, most important election of my lifetime. I don't want the far left in charge of this country. I've seen what they're doing in New York City. That city's falling apart under the communist de Blasio, and he is a communist. Portland, Oregon, I live there. That place is going down. Seattle, going down. Minneapolis, a shambles. All far-left people governing.
L.A.
I don't want that
LA
for the United States.
Yeah, L.A.'s already down. I live here. Bill, the book is called Killing Crazy Horse, The Merciless Indian Wars in America, available now on Amazon. Always an interesting chat, Bill. I hope we can do it again soon.
Anytime. Thanks for having me in, Corolla. I really appreciate
it. And by the way, no spin news as well. Thanks, Bill. We'll talk soon. All right. Let me just finish up with Geico here right now. Geico is offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies. That's 15% on top of the money you could be already saving if you were going with Geico. So what are you waiting for? There's never been a better time to switch to Geico. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 17th. Visit geico.com to learn more. That is geico.com. And a quick 15 seconds for Simply Safe. No one should feel unsafe at home, period. And that's why they're Simply Safe. Peel and stick, up and running in under an hour. Batteries last up to 10 years. Two eyes, simplysafe.com/Adam. Adam Ray tomorrow. What other show has this kind of range? Bill O'Reilly on to Adam Ray. Look forward to that. I want to thank Bet Online for being a great sponsor. And you can find all the live shows, Salt Lake City coming up, Lafayette, Louisiana coming up. Go to adamcarolla.com. Till next time, Adam Carolla for Bill O'Reilly and Jeff and Brian and Gina. Yeah, saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Thanks to Bet Online for sponsoring this podcast. And get everything you need at adamcarolla.com.